This is Gil Manser with our studio engineer, Anthony Garcia. Welcome you to September's Word by Word Conversations with Writers from Northern California Public Media, KRCB-FM. I am pleased to welcome a return visit with novelist and particle physicist and futurist, Ransom Steve, or pastiest. What's the better opposite of futurist?
Historian?
Historiist.
I don't know if I could be a historian, though.
That'd anyway, it's Ransom Stevens and his newest book, Too Rich to Die. A fifth-generation Californian, which is a rare breed, Ransom tells people, my family insists that Ransom is an Irish name, so I went to Ireland and asked around and no one had heard of it. So I don't know where I came from. Word by Word listeners best know Ransom as the author of a nonfiction book about neuroscience of innovation in art, science, and life called The Left Brain Speaks, But the Right Brain Laughs, and four novels, including The God Patent, The Sensory Deception, and two others which are part of Ransom's Times Weavers trilogy, which began with The 99% Solution and continues with the book we will chat about today, Too Rich to Die. Ransom, welcome again to Word by Word.
Thank you very much, Gil. It's very nice to be here.
All right. I think our listeners would appreciate a little bit of an explanation about the odd group, I'm being polite, of characters you call the Times Weavers.
The Time Weavers?
Time Weavers.
The Time Weavers consist of
Okay,
Simon...
why do I have Times Weavers?
It got stuck in your head, because why not?
I guess so. Time
you
Weavers.
Weave times.
Okay.
They are times.
Yeah, there's the a times they are
that.
A weaving.
It's a weave of time. Mm. So there's a lot of different strands.
That's right.
Each a timeline.
Okay.
So you can be forgiven for making the plural. Maybe I'll change it. So these three, my three musketeers, my three keyboard-wielding musketeers.
Well, you're not including your fourth?
I will.
Okay.
He always gets it. He's the asterisk. He's parenthetical.
Okay.
Simon Wentworth is a character that I sort of invented in the Vienna airport a long time ago, and I saw this man who looked very bewildered, like he had just scared a child and he had no idea how or what he could do to recover. And he just seemed befuddled.
Okay.
But he looked, you know, this is the thing, right? You're developing casts for things. So there's a lot of daydreaming that goes into developing characters. And just staring at him, it just seemed to me he looked really smart, but he looked really confused. And I know a gentleman who I won't name, and because he won't recognize himself if he listens in, who is this person who is very intelligent and constantly befuddled, and that is Simon Wentworth, who is the first person point of view character in most of the chapters of
All
both
right.
of these books.
We will find out why he's constantly befuddled in a little bit.
Yes, we will. Yes. I'm sure we will.
Okay. Then Fiona.
Fiona Black. Fiona Black is a person, the same sort of thing. I was on a cruise to Alaska, because that's the only cruise I've ever been on. And there was a table with a bunch of Australian people. And there was this woman there who looked sort of like Rachel Maddow. And she had this really cool tattoo on her chest of a crescent moon with a witch sitting on its point. And she was laughing and having a great time. And everyone at her table seemed to be trying to get her to be negative, and she just wouldn't bite.
Australians negative?
Well, she might have been the only Australian there. Oh. She was really the only one I could hear because she was loud and boisterous in that great stereotype of the Aussie, right?
Right. So she's the one who runs the intoxicating page.
Yes, she is.
Which is in our illustrious San Francisco.
On Valencia
Street.
You have
Street. To search hard and long for it, but it's there somewhere.
It's there in my brain. It's sort of very loosely kind of – I always think of Borderlands Bookstore.
Ah.
But it's very different than that since it's not just science fiction. And most importantly, it mixes cocktails with literature, the intoxicating page.
Right.
Which is a lot of fun.
It pairs them.
It pairs, yeah. Different. You think of walking into a liquor store and then what literature would you find in each section of the liquor?
Well, I can imagine ones from certain authors, can't you?
I can imagine lots of things, and I did my best to put them in there. Some of them are easier than others to the point where it's embarrassing. You know, Russian literature and Russian vodka. It's just too easy.
Yeah.
Bad, you know.
Yeah, but Hemingway made sense.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Mojito.
Right. And then we have Vlad, or Vladimir.
Volodya, yes. Vladimir Volodya Kazimir. This guy came to me. I went to a workshop on quantum chromodynamics in St. Petersburg,
chromodynamics. Russia. Chromo meaning colors.
Color. Yeah, it's the strong force, the strong nuclear force.
Ah.
So it was a conference. It was actually a workshop.
So color is a nuclear?
That's a different interview, different. Gil.
Oh, okay.
All right. We only have 58 minutes, right? Yes. All right.
So I went to this workshop in St. Petersburg, and one of the people who organized it was this guy named Igor. And for some reason
– Is this central casting?
It is in my head. Yeah, it is in my head. And for some reason, he like kind of assumed that I was sort of the leader of the Americans for no reason at all. I was junior faculty, and there were plenty of senior faculty. There was a Nobel Prize-winning physicist there, mm-hmm. but he always came to me with the problems. So every morning, Igor would come to me and say, there is a problem. And then he'd lay out something that I really didn't care about, and I'd say something like, oh, don't worry about it, Igor. It's going to be fine. And he would say – he would give this fake laugh. Yes, it is a problem. And then he'd walk away. And he was actually kind of a hoot. Later in the conference, we ended up finding the Russians late at night. They were disappearing to an office and drinking vodka and playing and singing Beatles songs.
Really?
And when we finally found them, then we joined them. You know, a few Americans, the guys from Fermilab and Slack. And we'd find them and we'd hang out with them and sing.
You're doing It's a Hard Day's Night?
That sort of thing. I particularly remember Rocky Raccoon
as
being my favorite sing-along with the Russians. But Igor was this guy, and mix in another particle physicist I knew who was named Vladimir, and his nickname is Volodya, and he once said to me, yes, Russian, only people who would add a syllable to a name to make it shorter. Volodya, the nickname for Vladimir.
Well, you remember reading the Russian novels and having to learn everybody's, you know, name that they used within the family, and then the one they used officially, and then the one they used in school, and they were all different.
Drives me crazy.
Yes, still does. Me too. We have one more character, a little shorter character.
Yes. Beagle. So,
Beagle, yes.
The Beagle, yes. Winter is Simon Wentworth's his service dog, and the service that he provides is that he helps Simon come back to reality when Simon gets lost.
Okay. Do you want to go into where he gets lost?
Sure.
All right.
Simon has an affliction or a talent, depending on how you feel about it. And that is that he experiences different timelines, different realities, if you will. And he falls backward and forward in time. Of course, when he falls backward in time, he falls into realities that actually existed. But when he falls forward in time, then, well, it's much less obvious. And so there are a lot more different threads in the future than there are in the past in my peculiar model of time's flow, which I try to keep really simple, where the past is well-defined to an objective observer if such a thing existed, and the future is a weave of possibilities. And Simon can experience these, and he does
now,
it at,
you mean experience them in his head or in physicality?
Well, that's a question that's never answered in these books, and I don't think I know the answer. And maybe in a later entry into this group, I hesitate to call it a series because there isn't, you know, you can read them in any order. They're all standalone. But yeah, I don't know the answer to that. He's been accused of being schizophrenic and having no end of different psychoses.
Mm-hmm.
He famously said once that he's lost all respect in psychology because a psychiatrist wants to accuse him of experiencing parallel realities. But what he really experiences are the intersections of realities. And the defining quality of things that are parallel is that they don't intersect.
Uh-huh.
This is the kind of thing that bothers Simon.
Well, San Francisco, of course, being the center of where this group meets, is important because, of course, it's on the ley lines, right? We know about, which there are the magnetic energy forces around the world. Do we get into that at any time?
We don't.
Okay. Do you believe in that? I mean, I was wondering.
It's
because
it's a thing. It's a MacGuffin that I thought about using. There's a lot of different approaches that I took, but of course, as a physicist, the one that in my head was always going were multiple realities with that would collapse onto the waveform of the reality that we actually experience. But I don't bother the reader with any of that stuff because I've learned over the many years that there are a lot of things that I might want to know about the books that I don't need to bore my readers with. And if they really want to know.
35 pages later.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, the fun thing is when I was reading it, what I kept flashing on and you know, we were formed with Star Trek in our past, right? And the one, of course, where the Enterprise lands in Golden Gate Park and saves the humpback whale from extinction, you know.
Star Trek IV.
But there was another one in the weekly series where they went into the past and Kirk met the only woman he ever fell in love with. And he couldn't save her from being hit by a truck or a bus or whatever it was because it would have changed everything in the future.
Right. That's the Back to the Future approach, which in my mind is really the only reasonable way to deal with time travel is that you put yourself, maybe you put everybody. Simon thinks that he puts everybody, brings everybody with him when he chooses a future.
Well, that's why it gets confusing because when he's like back in the French Revolution, everybody's there. Or are they?
Well, he's there, and no, the other characters aren't there when he goes back in time. He's alone and very, very acutely alone and when he falls into the past, usually in violent events or epics.
But summer's there.
Winter. Well, winter's always available to him in his mind because he's so close to him. But no, winter's what brings him out.
I know.
So when Simon falls into it.
So I assumed he was there with him.
That's fine.
Okay. That's how I read it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's good. I didn't write it that way, but that's totally cool. Well, that's the thing, right? I don't want to force feed anybody how I interpret it. It's like this is something that Stephen King said about how much detail to put into a book. You know, if the fact that the table is round and red is relevant to the story, tell me that it's round and red.
Right.
Other than that, I know what a table is. Don't bother me with it.
It's a green beige table. You know that you're going to play some poker on it, right?
You might.
Yeah, might. Okay, so we need to know a little bit more. If they have not read the 99% solution, and I don't know, we suggest that they do if they have not, but they don't have to read this before Too Rich to
Die. No, they're totally standalone.
What brought these disparate group of people, you know, who you've seen in airports and other places around the world, together in your mind so that they work as a team?
Well, Simon and Volodya met at a physics conference during the Cold War, and they argued a lot about arcane physics topics having to do with the structure of the nucleus. And in order to continue their argument, when Volodya went back to the Soviet Union and Simon went back to work at Lawrence Berkeley Lab, the only way they could continue their argument was to hack the telecom systems of the two world superpowers. So that's what they did.
Right.
And in the process, they got to listen in to Ronald Reagan arguing with Gorbachev and little tidbits like that, very few of which actually make it into the final drafts of
but it's
books.
In the backstory.
But it's in the backstory, and it's certainly a fun thing that I really enjoy, Volodya being a Cold War hacker and the fact that these two people hacked into the world superpowers a long time ago.
Yes.
And Fiona was a friend of Simon's in college who sort of took him under her wing because she really believes in him. She really believes that he experiences the future and the past and has this incredible talent to choose a future and that he's capable then of choosing more desirable futures than others. His friend Volodya doesn't believe a bit of it. He thinks that his buddy Simon is neurotic.
Right.
But still, they work together.
Very talented, though.
Oh, yeah. They're
very
talented.
They're all talented.
They're definitely very talented and yeah, I'm very fond of all of them.
So they run a business, international business, that's centered in Switzerland, isn't it?
In Vienna.
Vienna, okay.
TLA.
TLA. And it is that is their – but it's secret. You're not supposed to really know their connections.
They have a website.
Yeah.
It's a consulting agency.
A lot of people have websites.
It's in business to help customers guy work into the future to predict their possibilities of what might happen.
Right.
TLA stands for Timeline Associates in Vienna, where Volodya does the taxes. But in San Francisco, it stands for three-letter acronym, where Fiona does their taxes.
And they may not have the same numbers. We're led to believe that anyway. Yeah. Something, right? Because taxes are different in Vienna than they are here.
Yeah, well, right. I have no idea how that would actually work. Well,
it's complicated. So essentially what they're doing, that is their cash influx, because it's not from selling books and vodka.
That's for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, they make money, but it's also their access to information.
Because it is not just a bookstore. It is a
hangout sweatshop.
Right.
Yes.
Yes.
And their computing lab is
lowly paid hackers who are going to make it sometime in the future because they're going to come up with an app or something, right?
Yeah. They're training.
Right.
They're more like – it's more what? Like interns who interns. Are being guided by these veteran software people with a great deal of software development experience.
Mm-hmm.
And they help them. And they retain the rights to whatever software they develop.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't really know exactly how their algorithms are going to be used by the time weavers, who, of course, develop a software library that uses all of the information on the internet and in surveillance systems and any information that the time weavers can get their hands on to predict the future.
Right. Sort of like the Coke bar they have been doing with the energy sources.
Yeah, I suppose so.
There's a whole new book about that.
Oh, yeah? I didn't know that.
You have to pick it up, yeah.
You've read all of these books.
Well, yeah, the ones that get sent to me that I want to read.
That blows me away. Yeah. I really think that's cool.
It is, yeah. But remember, I get to pick and choose.
That's right.
I didn't care about the, you know, Australian dingo, for instance.
Oh, you didn't?
Well, I've read enough about them.
Okay.
Yeah. So let's go back with the start of this book, and I'm going to set it up. It's Market Street. The soon-to-be trillionaire, who is also soon to be 30 years old, is walking or hunching. I don't know. He kind of walks like
that. Yeah, he's always concentrating. He's looking
something.
Down.
Yeah.
He's worried. He's trying to figure out how he can make
no,
more money, solve
even
things.
Even though he's that rich, there's nobody around him protecting him from the world.
No.
Won't handle that because he doesn't want to pay for that.
Oh, he would never pay for that.
Yeah. And along the way, he is, I would say the word, accosted by a panhandler who
yes.
has a significant tattoo on her body and holds out a cup and demands $100.
Right.
Because she can tell he's rich.
She knows him.
We weren't sure of that at first.
Yet.
That's right. Right. We just see her as someone on the street.
So she asked him for $100.
Uh-huh.
That is never going to happen in Eben Scratch's universe at this point in his life.
That's right. And across the street is someone watching all this, and that's Mr. Simon Wentworth.
Yes.
And why is he there? How did he get there?
He's there because their software has predicted that something that will impact history is going to happen at that time and at that place, near that time, near that place. And so he's there just to keep an eye out and see what it might be.
All right. Well, at that time, when he's supposed to be watching out, can you read starting here?
Oh, sure.
And something is happening to Simon because he's having an episode, we'll call it, just right there. Yeah.
A seam forms. The seams resemble the green edges of sheets of glass, like windows separating inside from outside, one world from another. The vertigo draws me to the boundary and I fall. The hustle and bustle of Market Street shifts in focus. An executive waits in line for a cable car. As the tinted seam passes through him, his fine pinstriped suit shifts from contemporary elegant to Depression-era destitute. The line for the cable car evolves into a soup line, and what remains of his executive stature floats away on a foggy gust. His black fedora fades to gray and droops over his eyes. His skin weathers, his lips turn down, and his calloused hands reach for a bowl. I don't know if the world has spun off of its axis, but I have surely spun off of mine. I lean through the different seams, and each timeline induces sensations from trepidation to contentment, dread to hope, and anger to calm.
That's good.
Okay.
Because we got the point.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is what's going on in his mind while he's supposed to be watching out for some significant event.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll call it time event. This is the precipitation of something.
And he believes that these experiences are strongly correlated to these pivotal instants in history,
mm-hmm.
where history can go in one direction or another, but it is very unstable at that point.
And they can have an influence on that.
And they can influence it. Anybody who knows, if you know that that a particular butterfly flap of a butterfly wing can cause a tornado, you could probably catch the butterfly and keep it from flapping its wing and maybe prevent the tornado, or just blow on it a little so it wouldn't need to flap its wing.
Mm-hmm.
Or, right, these tiny pivotal instants in history, you know, we all experience them in our own lives. That little thing where you somehow met the person that you ended up marrying or working for or what have you.
That's right.
All these things can change on a dime. And so they find them. And what they do is they look out for events that can cause mostly bad things in history to happen,
mm-hmm.
so that they can try to keep things going.
Right.
Try to keep the world moving in the general direction of civilization, such as it is.
Okay. Well, we have these two people who met on the street, and that is a confluence, a start of something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is a historical pivot point,
a point where things can change,
where history can unravel.
Neither the two people who are involved know that.
No.
No.
They have no idea.
Right. He doesn't know who she is, doesn't remember at all. She knows who he is because apparently they worked together a few years ago. She has become a crack and heroin addict.
Yeah, she's fallen on hard times.
Yeah. And
he's fallen on hard times too.
He doesn't know it though.
No, he doesn't. He has no idea. How can you be the world's first trillionaire and feel like you've fallen on hard times?
He's going to be on the cover of Forbes magazine in a couple of days.
Yep, on his birthday.
Yep. Big deal.
The first day
should
of summer.
Should feel happy, shouldn't he?
Well, he thinks he's happy. Couldn't be happier.
He measures his happiness by the number of zeros after his wealth.
By every digit.
Yeah.
Right down to the fraction of the cent at the instant.
Right.
He is a greedy man.
A greedy man. Somewhat like a Scrooge.
Very much like.
Very much like. In fact, we'll find out about that. He has a man who's working for him, who is a third-generation Chinese, and occasionally slips into a Chinese patois.
Yao is a third-generation Californian of Chinese descent.
Okay, third-generation Californian of Chinese descent.
San Francisco. He grew up in Chinatown.
Right.
He's a good guy.
And his boss, I have no idea really why he stays with him, because he doesn't get paid what he should. And he keeps being deducted. He gets like that. You remember the demerits in high school when somebody would take things off, you know, because you, I don't know, walked in too fast or something like that? Oh, that's two demerits. I had one guy like that as a teacher. Hated him.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's what this employer does.
That's right.
He starts, and then the man asks, well, you know, I need to get off early today because I have to go to the hospital with my son for another treatment. And he says, well, what are you going to do? You've already used up all your comp time. You don't have any, you know, where are we going to get it? We'll have to take it out of your pay. Yeah.
So that's how Eben Scratch destabilizes Yao. Yao has no idea how important he is to this company.
Mm-hmm.
All he knows is that he can't write software.
Mm-hmm.
He, you know, this is a job that he got. He could probably get another job, but this one actually is the highest paying job he's ever had. He's destabilized. A lot of employers do this.
It's not the high paying jobs. Most of the people in the high tech industry, you know, they're expecting the high salaries.
Not if they're a lowly admin, right? He gets Eben his coffee. He does his agendas. He arranges his travel. He actually is the chief operating officer of the company, but he doesn't know it.
Yeah.
And Eben keeps that from him until he is redeemed.
Right. You're jumping ahead. Don't do that. Okay. So anyway, that's our cast of characters really for the first, four or five chapters of the book. And we see others occasionally. There's, you know, people that what's the lady who lives on the street? Her name is
Allison.
Allison sells. She's got a group of clients and a provider.
And some friends,
And
yeah.
some friends.
Yeah.
But they're pretty sketchy.
They are sketchy.
Yeah. Now, I seem to remember from some of your other books that you've had other things that occurred in the streets of San Francisco as well. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Yeah, so you must walk around there enough to keep your observation pretty accurate.
I love San Francisco.
Yeah. Well, okay, should we talk about the result of this chance meeting?
Sure.
Sure. I'm going to read you and let you read the quote that's posted. Oh. All right?
All right.
Isn't that an interesting thought? So Scratch goes back to his office and decides that he's so repulsed. Is that a good word?
Yes.
By the confrontation. By these do-nothings.
And you want me to put this...
Do you want me to read it for you?
Yeah, I don't want this in my voice.
All right. Anyway, this man, this not very nice man, I'm only going to read part of it.
Okay.
Puts on his 5,000 friends on some unnamed, very similar to Facebook posting.
Sort of social networking thing.
Market Street is disgusting. The heart of this rich city is teeming with drug abusers, failures, and the criminally insane. Losers of every stripe, human trash. They act like they belong here, like they have a right to our streets. It's unacceptable. And he goes on and on. And the similarity of his words and the similarity of some other person's words in a very powerful job right at this moment, I think are done intentionally.
Yes.
Yes.
That's part of where I got the idea for this character. You will recall, I think it was 5-6 years ago, that there was a young techie startup CEO who posted this sort of vile, disparaging
rant
on Facebook. And it went viral and it got a sort of astounding number of likes.
Yes.
But it was rotten. And he later apologized for it, and I don't know how much he redeemed himself.
He wasn't the boss, though.
But well, he was. He was actually.
Oh, was he boss?
Yeah,
of the company?
he was the boss of a startup that I think flamed out. But he still works for VCs as a sort of scout, venture capitalist, as a sort of scout.
Interesting.
There's also along these lines the person who owns Eben owns this beach.
Right.
And this will sound a little familiar, too.
Oh, I know this beach, yes.
That he owns this beach that you cannot access except by crossing his land.
There's a beach much like it in Santa Barbara.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Identical, right. Yeah. Yeah. Very much. You can
only
access
get there
it
by boat.
By boat.
Yep.
We're at very low tide.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So there are a bunch of, rotten capitalist scoundrels that are combined into this character.
I mean, like the people who'd go over and buy a whole Hawaiian island for themselves.
That sort of thing. Or maybe more like the sort of people who would go and violate national park laws to build a castle so that they can have their wedding and then just pay the multi-million dollar fine as a part of the cost of their wedding.
Well, what happens is, and I don't know, should we tell this or not? What happens because of that post on Facebook is there is a social upheaval. Fair?
Yeah, there is an upheaval. Right. People come after him. Just like they did, for mm-hmm. the representative slice of reality on which I based that.
Mm-hmm. You are listening to September's Word by Word Conversations with Writers from Northern California Public Media, KRCB-FM. Today, we are delighted for the chance of a return visit with the novelist, futurist, and particle physicist Ransom Stevens and his newest book, Too Rich to Die. We have already learned about the swashbuckling hackers in the Beagle who make up the mysterious group collectively known as the Time Travelers, and met a Scrooge-like tech billionaire on the cusp of his 30th birthday. So stay tuned for the next half hour of time tickling between Gil and Ransom. What do these group of people, somewhere you refer to them as the swashbucklers, do with this information? They know the woman on the street. They know the man who's the trillionaire-to-be. Both of them worked for them
both of them had worked as software, had written code for them back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
And so the three swashbucklers, they've determined that there is going to be a problem because Eben Scratch is too rich. He has so much money that if he makes a mistake, he can bring the world's economy down with him.
Right.
And he's destined to make a mistake
right.
due to his values, which is basically he wants all the money. He wants all of it. And he's got an idea for how he can get it. And by all of the money, I mean all of the money in the world. And not just the printed money, but all the money in principle. And it's possible to have a balance that is as large as the total sum of money in the world and loan it out in such a way that it's distributed, but you actually could claim ownership to the total value. And he's
– And you keep your principle.
This could cause a problem, right?
It could.
Every description of a novel ultimately ends, this, and this happens, and then there's a problem.
Right.
A problem.
Yes, to Russia and the United States. Yes. For the whole world. For the world as we know it.
Well, the economies are tied together.
Mm-hmm.
If you bring them all down, they all
There's only so
come
much
down.
Money.
And who suffers the most?
Right. Well, yeah. Of course, the man who's, you know, got the most money thinks he's going to suffer the most, but his suffering is at such a different level.
Isn't that a weird thing?
Yeah. He's in this, you know, mansion, and he only lives in three rooms.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. The 49th floor of a mansion on Nob Hill.
Right.
Yeah. It always strikes me when corporate titans complain about how much they have to lose compared to their employees.
Right.
Right. Sure, you might lose a few million dollars, but guess who's not going to be homeless and who might be if they lose $500?
Mm-hmm.
It's a question of
scale.
Well,
you've seen the things about how much people have in cash.
Yeah.
You know, if you can't use a credit card to pay for something, you're up the creek.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Soon a phone.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. The other thing, of course, is that the fact of having him live on Nob Hill, you immediately tie into the history of the gazillionaires of their era who were all living there in their mansions and built these, you know, fantastic palaces up there.
Which is another theme, the historic theme of the old money and the new money.
Right. But this new money is really new because he's only been at it for 5 years.
Yes.
So, I mean, to get there in that period of time took a certain dedication, shall we say.
Yes.
Yes.
Obsession, you might even go.
Or so just
far.
Damn luck.
Well, it never happens without luck. And some excellent help from some very talented people, one in particular.
Right. Right. Well, I was going to say three in particular because he ends up using their code to build on to build, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, for a very different application though.
Right.
But, Eben Scratch's app, the currency app, which is current C-S-E-A, but is currency. Is a banking
Oh, really?
App.
Is that what it is?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Currency. So this is an app that becomes widespread, and it's a banking app that optimizes rich people's purchases for anything, their investments, their taxes. It moves money from one currency to another to optimize their gain at every point, and every transaction incurs a small fee.
Right.
And as we all know from watching Office Space, that if you collect that last penny, you will get rich very quickly.
Or even a percentage of a penny.
Yes. The last fraction of a cent will still make you wealthy, provided you're collecting billions of them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's basically the idea of the currency app.
Well, there are some apps out there which provide a similar kind of service. They will get you the best price on any car or the best price on your real estate or, you know, make the greatest deal of whatever you're trying to do, even buy a beach off the coast of California. Right?
And you click agree.
Yep.
You click to the agree terms and the conditions.
Terms. Right. Okay. So where do we want to go next with this? We've got – well, let's take our street person back to the bookstore. Is that a good place to go?
Sure.
Okay. And she is used to work for them. They know her. She knows them. She has really fond feelings for all of them.
She does.
Yeah.
She's in a hard spot
right.
at this point.
However, she is an addict first and foremost.
Yep.
Yep. So she makes all these promises, all these deals. I think the one that probably sees right through her is Volodya.
Volodya trusts no one. Except perhaps Simon and Fiona.
Right.
He doesn't even trust the dog, Beagle. He's suspicious by nature.
Right.
And, well, she is. She's an addict, and she's in a hard spot. So these are two, you could say, reprehensible characters that need eventually to
Who are the two reprehensible? We've got the addict and the money guy.
And the rich guy, right. Eben Scratch, the man who will be the world's first trillionaire.
Yeah, but they have a connection.
And Allison.
More than just meeting on the street.
That's right.
And we'll give that away. Are there any things you like to read from the book that you want to share with our listeners?
Gosh, I hadn't thought of that. I usually just read from the beginning, but we already did that.
We kind of did that. I've got some things marked. Let's see what I marked.
I never thought that I would write a redemption story, but that's what this is.
Well, I don't know. I don't want to get into this too much, but there are certain parallels between this story and another story which most of us already know.
Right. We can get into that.
Can we get into that?
Yeah. There's no great secret.
It is, of course, a Christmas carol.
It is a Christmas carol, but instead of Christmas, it is the summer solstice.
Right. And the summer solstice is always celebrated around here by something called Bohemian Grove. So that's a good thing to talk about.
Yeah.
Have you been there?
No, I have not been to Bohemian Grove. But I have done a lot of research on it.
From what I can understand, your description is pretty correct.
I hope so.
The owl and the entrance and the gates.
And the treehouse. The treehouse is featured in the 99% solution.
Right.
These things fascinate me. These ways that the ultra wealthy have to try to separate themselves from the rest of humanity and then seal that off as if it actually makes them different somehow, and working through the power. So the root of this is that Simon Wentworth grew up in Monterio.
Right.
And as many—
Learned to swim in the Russian River.
Learned to swim in the Russian River. Who didn't?
Well, that's important later on in the book.
Yeah.
Yes.
He grew up right by the Russian River. I forget the name of the street, but I've wandered around and looked and seen where the characters are. And he, like a lot of people who grew up in Monterio, he works at the Bohemian Grove
in the summer. Yeah.
Of course, only men are allowed to be there after 5 p.m.
That's the theory.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, although I heard that they might be loosening that and allow women. I don't know.
Well, I think they had loosened it in the past, my understanding.
Periodically?
Yeah.
So he's also, as a notable physicist, has a sort of honorable membership in the Bohemian Grove.
Mm-hmm.
And since Simon is such a sort of innocent, by lack of guile, sort of person, he really, it never occurs to him that anything could be going wrong at the Bohemian Grove or that anything could be, amiss by having these wealthy men there. He pretty much takes it as given how it's organized.
Well, one of the things is they're not supposed to talk shop.
Right.
Right.
No tangled webs.
No tangled webs.
No webs we shall weave here. That's not it, but
something like that.
And so, this is where Eben, as one of the very wealthy people in San Francisco, is a member of the Bohemian Grove, though, of course, he complains bitterly that it's such a waste of time to go there and do these stupid things when he should be in the shop working.
Except that's not what happens when he gets there, is it?
The goofy things?
No, it's not. Being angry about being there.
He's
in summer camp.
Right. He's in summer camp at the Bohemian Grove, though he's not a very social person.
No.
At this point in his life. He had been at one point, and maybe he will be again someday. But at this point, he's not social at all. No more social than Ebenezer Scrooge was through the first third of A Christmas Carol.
Of course, when we first see him at the Grove, when Simon first sees him at the Grove, he's sitting in a circle, and one man who is holding up the Forbes magazine cover and saying, "See, you can make it."
Yeah.
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 And he feels very uncomfortable with that.
Right.
He'd much rather be left alone. And, a lot of things I've found in writing novels that making the – at this point, Eben's the villain. And I think that basing the villain on yourself is a really good way to go, because then they're sort of guaranteed to have some humanity to them.
Mm-hmm.
So I get really uncomfortable in those situations too.
Right. Well, we have some flashbacks showing things that happened when he was young.
Well, a character can't be reprehensible the whole way, and you still want to read him.
Right.
And he was a kid. He was a nice boy.
Quiet.
Quiet. Yeah.
Yeah.
He liked to play Marco Polo in the pool.
He liked to do things with his sister, who now bugs him because she wants to go to the beach.
She wants to take him to the beach.
Take him to the beach, but the only reason that she wants him to be there is he has the key to the gate.
No, that's what he thinks.
Oh, it's not true, huh?
It's not true.
She can get through the gate?
No. She lives in Santa Barbara. She doesn't need to go to his beach. She can go to any beach she wants.
Yeah.
And she doesn't care about it. She's just worried about her little brother.
Right. With good cause.
Yeah.
Because he is becoming more and more stooped by the minute and more insular and more dependent upon his administrative assistant, although he would never admit that.
Never.
Never. Anyway, so they're at the Bohemian Grove. Now, earlier in the book, we have a pattern which appears sporadically when the light is right, or I'm not sure why it appears, but it'll appear on the wall or the floor or something like that. And it's from a video game, right?
It's from a video game, yeah.
It's the logo for the game.
It's the logo for the game, for Thieves' World, which is a game that I made up.
Right. I look for it. It's not there.
No, it's not there. I would have changed it to something else if I got it right the first time.
Right.
But no, it doesn't exist, so not violating anybody's.
Okay. Well, no, I didn't think that. I thought you were, were going to come up with an app for it and make a fortune.
So what he does, though, is what all superstitious people do, is that if you look and you see, you see the, like, you're looking in the water stains for, looking at, trying to find a poem and the water stains on the floor is the lyric from some song I really like. And that's what happens if you're afraid of seeing something and you're in that mood and you see a cloud or you see a puddle, you will see the symbols that you fear much more often than you'll see symbols that you hope to see.
Right.
And so the Time Weavers find this out and they use it to manipulate him because they have evidence that if they don't help Eben overcome his problem with greed, that very, very bad things will happen to the vast majority of people on Earth.
Right. So Simon goes up to join Evan at the Bohemian Grove with
his dog Winter.
With his dog Winter.
His service dog.
And they let the dog in because the man at the gate, because he's wearing his little service dog vest.
Yep.
Right. Man at the gate says, oh, you can't bring that. Yeah. Oh, okay. Yes, you can. Oh, I know you.
Even though he won't heal.
Yeah.
Yeah, Winter's just a horrible service dog. He never behaves. He doesn't look – he's just – but he helps – he actually is a service dog.
And he comes in to aid things at just the right time.
He does. Yeah. But no beagles were hurt in the writing of this book.
No.
It's very important to note that.
Important to note. I love how you describe him, but I'm going to leave that for the readers to find out. Okay, I'm trying to think of how much we can give away. Shall we say we'll take these pieces of information – that we have this superstitious feeling from our main villain, right? And we have this man who can manipulate the future somewhat. And one of the ways he does that, one of the ways he does that is with 5 bags of flour.
Yes.
And several bottles of very good wine.
Several bottles of fine red wine. We are, after all, situated in Monterio at the Bohemian Club.
That's right. So you want to describe what he does, or should we leave that out?
Yeah, sure. Okay. So what Simon does, and he does this under the direction of Fiona and Valodia.
In his ear.
In his ear, yeah. They have some technology so
some
that they're
satellite.
Always in contact.
Contact, yeah.
Which lends the sort of Three Musketeers notion to them, that they are connected and able to listen in on each other's lives pretty much whenever they want.
Right.
They can turn it off if they want to be left alone, but they rarely do. So Simon goes and uses flour along the trails in the Bohemian Grove. The Bohemian Grove is – think of it as like Armstrong Woods.
Mm-hmm.
It's a series of paths in the hills, in the coastal hills, in a redwood forest.
About the same age of forest too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he goes and uses – he sprinkles out flour in the shapes of these symbols to trigger Eben Scratch's superstitions, to direct him in different to take different routes,
right,
to try and get him to a specific spot which was one of Simon's favorite places when he was a boy,
right, when he was working there.
Yeah, when he was working there.
Right.
And that is a spot where he then talks to gets Eben drunk and listens to him.
I'm trying to remember how many bottles of wine they consumed. Five, I think.
It was at least three. Yeah, they each
started
had
out
one.
With Pinot, no, then were... Zinfandel, then Cabernet, then yeah.
Yeah, yeah, that was a lot of wine.
A lot of wine.
Poor Simon the next day.
Yeah, he had a head. But of course, the Beagle's not left out because he got to drink locally produced IPA.
Or was it more locally produced?
More local. Was yes. Locally produced or more locally?
Yeah.
I like
hey,
that.
We are on the West Coast.
Yes.
Just a saucerful.
That's, well.
Just a bit.
Yeah, that time. But didn't they get some later, too?
Well, you get a little bit more.
Yeah.
Okay. Dogs like beer.
They do.
They shouldn't have too much. It's you know, they're little.
So anyway, we've got these two men in the woods, one manipulating the other without him knowing it. There's kind of a naivete about our trillionaire at this point.
Oh, there certainly is.
Yes. Because he really doesn't have real life.
No. He's very focused on one thing.
Yeah.
He thinks of money as points, and mm-hmm. he wants to win.
Right.
And that's completely possesses him.
Mm-hmm.
So the very concept that the results of his actions could hurt someone really doesn't occur to him.
He's not empathetic at all.
No.
No.
He's capable of it. He just isn't doing it now.
So is he a sociopath?
If he is, it's not – it's acute, not chronic.
It's not cute at all, frankly.
It's acute. It's,
yes.
You know, it's a – he's afflicted with it now, but it's not chronic. It's not – you know, it's curable. He is, but it's mostly because he's got tunnel vision.
Mm-hmm. That's what you do. You get up in the morning and you do this and you try to build up your stack of gold higher and higher and higher.
And that's all he does.
That's all he does. Really, that's all he does.
Until something has to break through to him.
All right. Well, we're not going to go through in what breaks through.
All right.
All right. Because that involves all kinds of travel to different places. We're going to go to India and we're going to Paris. And we're going to just all kinds of fun things.
Mexico.
So – I think it's interesting and quite revealing that the villain of the piece is Ransom Stevens in disguise.
That's always true.
Yeah.
In all of my books, yeah. It is, I think.
So yeah, what yeah. part of this particular character appeals to
well,
you?
Well, certainly not the greedy part, unfortunately.
I'd be more focused.
Yeah. No, I'm pretty focused. No, so the parts of Eben that are me are all these – the little tiny things. Like he's very irritable about a bunch of stupid things. Now, I wouldn't consider myself generally irritable, but there are a couple of dumb things that really annoy me,
mm-hmm.
like tapping on a table. Gosh.
Yeah.
When someone says, my gosh.
I noticed
gosh
that.
Gosh is
in
not
the book.
A
yeah.
word.
It's funny because a book I've been reading before I read yours – which we talked about last this month, just a couple days ago, is the woman is a heir to the throne. She's the 35th in line to the British throne, and she uses gosh and golly all the time. And her new husband keeps suggesting that she shouldn't do that.
Really?
Yes.
Why?
Because that's the one she learned in school, and that's what you did, because that you only have certain few words you can use as expletives.
Right, and Eben figures if you're going to swear, you should swear.
Right.
Gosh isn't a word.
No.
What are you trying to say?
Right. And so does Ransom.
Yeah, yeah.
Because there's a few
swear words.
It's
not something I like
here,
to
right?
admit. Yeah. Yeah, there are.
Yeah. Especially from our street lady.
Well, yeah, because she's – right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's where she is at this point in
right.
her life.
Right.
And she is – she was tough to make a sympathetic character.
Okay. Let's talk about her.
Allison.
Because when we first meet her.
When we first meet her, she is.
She is a stereotypical character.
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah, she is. But that doesn't make her an unlikely character.
Right.
You know, there's lots of Allisons out there. And
mm-hmm.
She's a nickel dime bag dealer in San Francisco.
Right.
Working for. You know, a real gangbanger type and selling drugs and doing drugs on the street behind Edinburgh Castle.
Mm-hmm.
So is more or less where it's set around Polk Street in O'Farrell. And yeah, she's hardcore, but she wasn't always.
No.
And
again, it's a 5-year slide for her.
Yeah, yeah. It was a tough slide where she just really she's not an extraordinarily resilient character. That's just not a feature of her personality. She was easily defeated.
She's really not street smart either.
She's not street smart. She thinks she is. But she does have one thing. She loves animals, and animals love her.
Including our little beagle.
Oh, yeah. Winter loves her to pieces.
Yeah.
And she has a rapport with pigeons in the cities and animals. They like her. She's got something. There is something about her that is not rotten.
Yeah, that's interesting because druggies generally don't have animals with them because they smell, chemical. Yeah.
Really? I didn't know that.
Oh, the breath. Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah.
Well, they're not eating well. Their teeth are not being taken care of. Their hygiene is usually not the first thing they're thinking of. They're thinking of the next fix.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not to overgeneralize.
Right.
But yeah.
Right. Well, there is – addiction is hard.
It's in the system. It's like an alcoholic. You can, can smell it. Yeah.
Yeah, I did a lot of research to get Allison right. The worst thing I think you can do is have a stereotypical character that's wrong, where you just miss it. You're trying to do something, and she's only stereotypical for a little while, but she is at first.
At first, yeah.
Because
they tried to do and help her. They set her up with rehab.
Yeah.
You can go. We'll take you. This kind of stuff.
Right. They get her all
and
set
she
up.
She says, "Yeah, that's fine, but I just need a fix until that."
Yeah,
happens.
Yeah, I'll be fine because she will go into withdrawal, and if they want to talk to her. They can't really talk to her when she's suffering withdrawal symptoms.
Yeah, but Volodya's figured it out. The best way to do it is you can give her half a dose if you do it with vodka.
Yeah, old Russian technique. You substitute vodka for half of the
cocaine. She doesn't know she's had half a dose. Yeah. They're good characters here.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
I like them.
I think you should. Yeah. So the next question, obviously, is there going to be a third in the series?
I have a third mapped out, but I haven't started writing it. So
same
I
characters
don't know.
In it or not?
Well, just the three characters, the Time Weavers, are the only ones that map through.
Yeah, but the other two could be part of the Time Weavers because they are so talented at what they did and do. They could still be sitting at the table.
They can certainly show up.
Yeah.
And the same could be said of the hackers in the 99% solution, that they sort of randomly show up and make cameos in Too Rich to Die, but you wouldn't even notice unless you read
that.
Are they
ones at the table?
Yeah.
Yeah. I thought that so.
You did notice.
I did notice, yeah. Okay. What do you find – are you reading this to people yet?
I've done a couple
You've
of readings.
You've done a couple readings?
Yeah.
What kind of feedback are you getting?
Because
we had a discussion about this, one of your earlier books, and, when the physicist goes out and stands in front of the room – everybody goes.
Yeah, there's something weird about the author's platform, where you get typecast.
Yeah,
and it's kind of strange, though you can't really do anything about it. So the hell with it, right?
Well, we don't talk like you're a physicist with each other.
Right.
Yeah.
We do, but you just don't know what physicists talk like.
Well, that's. I know several physicists.
Right.
I did want to ask you about the green color in glass and why it on the edges it's green. Because I remember seeing that when I was in junior high, and we had this huge auditorium, and they put these red velvet curtains over the windows, and the air edge would always have this green tinge to it when the sun came through.
Yeah, it's kind of the same reason that the sky is blue.
Because it is.
Yeah, because the wavelengths, the higher or the smaller wavelengths down in the blue side scatter more than the larger wavelengths on the red side of the rainbow.
Okay.
And so the sky is blue because the blue light scatters away from the sun. If you look at the sun, it's yellow. The farther away from it you look, the less yellow the sky is until it's blue.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same sort of effect with the glass, though the glass also has impurities and things,
right.
And there's a lot of different.
This is 1930s centers. Glass too that it, where it was coming through. So,
and certainly lead crystal does the same thing, to a different degree than just any old melted silicon dioxide.
Right. Well, thank you. Good to know. See, that's the kind of stuff we talk about.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. So anyway, we're back to the people that are seeing you on the podium or on the dais or whatever it is you've got it in the bookstore or the whatever. And they're sitting out there on the squeaky chairs. And they all have questions.
Yeah.
What kinds of questions do they ask?
So for Too Rich to Die, there's a lot of questions about the sorts of things we've talked about in terms of – there's always questions about where did you get your characters.
Right.
And I can go on and on and on about that just like I already have.
Yeah.
So there's those questions. And then there's questions about the technology. And a common question is that I have been quoted somewhere along the line of saying that all of the technology in my books is possible right now.
Right.
And that's a bit of a stretch here. It was certainly true in my first two novels, that everything that appeared in those two novels could be built off the shelf parts.
I think that's probably where
the
quote came from, was when you were talking about those novels, because that's what you tell people.
Right. Yeah. And it's true here, though there's
two flaws. The
sensory
deception, for instance.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm sure you did.
Yeah. There's two flaws to it. First, the biggest one is that the technology is possible, but it sure couldn't be developed as fast as these two people do.
Mm-hmm.
These two people plus a whole bunch of subcontracted intern-like people working out of this bookstore, liquor store in San Francisco. So that's the biggest flaw is that, this is possible, but it'd take a lot longer to develop it than it does in a book, right? Just like it would in a movie or whatever.
Yeah.
And the other is that this would be possible. It is certainly possible, and a lot of people are trying to do it, to develop technology that can predict the future based on all of the data that exists on network devices.
Mm-hmm.
The difference is that the uncertainty is much larger than in real life than it is for these characters in these books that are able to narrow down the possibilities of or the probabilities for different futures to a few percent.
Did you used to read science fiction when you were a kid?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Gobs
so you did
gobs.
The future history series and stuff like that?
A few.
Yeah. Heinlein and Asimov kind of stuff.
Oh, what's that guy's name? I can picture him, but I can't think of his name. He's done a ton of it. And my favorite alternative history is the history of England during Shakespeare's time, but if the Spanish Armada had won.
Had won.
Yeah. Turtledove. Harry Turtledove.
Right. Yeah, I love those kinds of things, too.
Yeah, me too.
We're kind of nerdy, aren't we?
They're brilliantly creepy. Where the South wins the
war, yeah.
And then they end up on the Nazi side in World War II. Oh, geez, the Confederates against the – it's ugly.
Well, that's kind of the basis of a TV show now, so
Yeah. Sometimes I think it's the basis of our government, but that's a different
topic. That's another topic. We're not going there. Although I'm going to come and end up with that today. You'll hear what I'm talking about when we get there. You have been listening to September's Word by Word Conversations with Writers from Northern California Public Media, KRCB-FM. Today we had a return visit with the novelist, futurist, and particle physicist Ransom Stevens and his newest book, Too Rich to Die. We learned about the swashbuckling hackers and their beagle, who make up the mysterious group collectively known as the Time Travelers, met a Scrooge-like tech billionaire on the cusp of his 30th birthday, and uncovered the crucial role the city of San Francisco plays as a confluence center in which identifying the magnetic energies of the tectonic plates, although Ransom's not sure that's necessary. Our studio engineer for today's show has been Anthony Garcia. Station manager is Sean Knight. Radio coordinator is Wendy Nicholson. Podcast archivist is Mark Prell. The theme music is by Bill Conti, and I'm your host, Gil Manser. We invite you to tune into the next Word by Word broadcast from 4 to 5 on Sunday afternoon, October 13th, when our guest will be the satirical author and the cartoonists responsible for The Sun Also Sets, a Seussical Indictment of Trump.